The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today we continue the Best Of show where we go back and play clips from people that we feel had particular insights that we want to carry into 2013.
As promised, we'll begin with Ian McCavity and then move on to Bill King. And finally, with Mark Faber, we'll end the day. And what we want to look at is not just the precious metals market, but as Ian begins the conversation today, a broader view of the equity markets, both here in the U.S. and globally. Let's go to our first clip with Ian. Starting with the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500, let's just begin with this. Other than counterfeiting, what could fuel the markets rise, say, another 15-20% from here?
I don't see the market going much higher from here. I think we're basically in the vicinity of a very significant top. And as far as I'm concerned, the majority of the market really topped out back in 2011. And we've seen higher highs on some U.S. indices since then. But 13 out of 15 world markets that I track have not made higher highs in 2012. And some of the broader indexes in the U.S. have also not made higher highs. So as far as I'm concerned, we're at the top of a cycle within this secular trend that really dates from 2000. And in my view, I think we're going down a lot more than people think. I think we're going to go back and see the March 2009 lows before this is all done. It's not all going to happen in one stage, but to me, they've essentially extended this cycle by about 12 months, dragging it on and on, and we're going to pay for that on the other side, because the more you extend it in the one direction, the laws of physics take over and create the equal but opposite reaction on the other. In my view, the balance of 2012, I think people are way too optimistic, and 2013, 2014, I think are going to be quite challenging. Now, you've got a global slowdown underway that is, in many respects, still accelerating. It was sort of ironic over the weekend to see some data in which they were aghast that Spain's government debt to GDP ratio was going to be 90%. I sort of chuckled because that's better than the United States, but the U.S. commentators didn't bother to point that out.
Well, David, Ian has been very accurate in the past, and he does see a slowdown in 2013 and 2014. You know, you hear the commentators talking about the stock market possibly having a new boost. Let's say if Washington comes up with some sort of solution. But in reality, he thinks that at this point, we've seen significant highs.
Now, on the other side of that, he looks at the gold market and says, from a technical perspective, looking at the 50 and the 200-day moving averages, there's been some very intriguing things that have happened here in the latter part of 2012 that define the course for 2013. Let's look at what he has to say on that particular point.
The history of the gold 50 to 200 ratio has been very strong and with very, very few false starts. That's one of the reasons why I pay as much attention to it as I do. And in my view, at this point, you've now got the 50-day moving average rising at a faster rate than the 200-day. And the 50 crossed up through the 200 about a week ago, to confirm that this little breakout of the downtrend line of the last few months, this little breakout is real. We've tested the 1550 to 1625 area three or four times over the past year, and we're now going in the other direction to try and confirm a breakout by getting through 1800. Go through 1800, go through 1900. Those are the two upside thresholds, and then basically it's Katie bar the door for a couple of $100 move beyond that. That's been the nature of this cycle when you look at the charts on a logarithmic scale, because, you know, you've got to think of it in percentage terms or semi-log scale type terms. And in my view, I think there's still a good possibility we see something like 2200 or 2300 before the end of this year. We're in the fourth quarter of the year already. I think we're that close to a significant change in character.
Well, David, one of the things that we talk about, too, is timing is so hard to predict. You know, we were looking at a cycle now where gold has, it's consolidated for about 15 or 16 months. Now, that's something that is not new. Over the last decade, we've seen that happen. Well, this is the fourth time. So as we go into the beginning of the year, maybe we'll start to see what Ian was calling for towards the end of the year.
And I think that's precisely what we will see, the change in character, which he noted. No, we're not at 21, 2200 here at year end, but we may see that in short order as we head into 2013, because again, from a technical perspective, we have sort of cleared the decks. The consolidation is over, and now we do see this change of character heading into 2013.
Well, and I'll tell you, it's worth talking to an awful lot of different people, because people do have different opinions, and we're talking about strong market practitioners, David. Well, and of course, David, we don't want to neglect silver. You know, silver is something that comes to mind when someone thinks of gold, but usually when we're talking about gold, we're talking about each one. And so let's go ahead and see what Ian has to say about that particular market.
Well, I've done a lot of historical work on the silver-gold ratio because, in essence, when you've got a heated-up gold market, then silver becomes gold on steroids. People revert to its monetary history, even though it doesn't really have an official monetary role any longer. But I still think of it trades on its monetary history. And in essence, from 1984 to last year, it had been locked in a broad range that was, I would say, roughly 45 to 1 to 1. Silver was rich relative to gold, and anything over 80 to 1, silver was cheap relative to gold. And on that run to $50 that we had back in 2011, on that run, it got to about 30 to 1 on the futures. And in my view, as a technician, that breakout occurred at around the 60 to 1 level. So I've been working on the hypothesis that last year's move probably broke it out of that old 45 to 80 range and may have set up a new range going forward, at which we may see 30 to 1 as an extreme, where silver's ahead of gold, or 60 to 1 where silver is cheap relative to gold. And on the recent correction period, when the prices were lower, we were in the 55, 56 area, which is where I started to really feel that the 55 to 60 ratio was going to be a good opportunity entry level for the silver market. And if you go back prior to 1984, when silver gold was 45 to 1, silver was cheap relative to gold, and at the extremes, it was as little as 15 to 1. Now, Eric Sprott, who's been a promoter of a couple of the large new ETFs in recent years, keeps talking about going back to 15 to 1. I'm sort of not anxious to see that happen, because when it's happened in the past, it's been very sharp and very brief. And again, I'm not a big fan of looking for moonshot kinds of things that might be the end of a cycle kind of move. But I would recognize that it's entirely possible you may see 15 to 1 at some point in the much later stages of this cycle. But for now, I'm working on a practical range of 60 to 1 silver is cheap, 30 to 1 silver is probably a little rich.
Like Ian's last comment, what we're really talking about is a change in character, a change in character from a bull market in gold, which is moving through a period of consolidation, and finally going to higher numbers. And this change of character between gold and silver, an internal dynamic where silver was outperforming and then stepped back and is now likely again in the mode of outperformance again, as that ratio shrinks. The smaller the number, the greater the outperformance for silver, as counterintuitive as that may seem.
David, one of the things that I really enjoy about working here with our clients, with the philosophy that we have, is the measuring things in relative value. We talked about it in the last program, measuring gold relative to the Dow, not the currency. Measuring silver relative to gold, because, you know, granted, gold and silver typically move up together in the long run if you step back from the chart, but there are some profits to be taken if you go with one or the other based on the ratio.
Now, in the next interviews with Bill King, we start with the idea that market prices are not reflective of today's larger economy, and the importance of relative values is really brought home with this particular reflection, because when you're looking at prices and assuming that it's communicating something real to you, you have to realize that things are not always as they seem, and having the perception of true value according to relative value is absolutely imperative. Let's go to the King interview. In our family, I'm the optimist, and I'm not seeing it. I think the market has it terribly wrong. It's woefully complacent. You know, we've had somewhat disappointing earnings, and yet we find ourselves above 13,000 on the Dow. If you take out the financials, we're at all-time highs in the S&P 500. What am I not seeing here, Bill? I mean, the market knows something that I don't, or is the market just dead wrong?
Well, it's not a question of dead wrong. The market is, you know, is reality. That's what the prices are. But what is different is the stock market no longer reflects economic activity. It is not a gauge. For centuries, it was a gauge of economic, a barometer of the economy. Well, that all fell apart. over the last decade or so because you had a huge divergence. Well, you know, it's a game. It's a casino parlor game, and it's largely because of the easy money. And that's what's perverted the stock market. And that is what's vexing the Fed. You know, if you remember when Bernanke was taken to task by Congress or the media about what did QE2 do, the first word out of his mouth, it got the stock market up. It had nothing to do with the economy, and it didn't. In fact, it hurt the economy by getting inflation roaring in 2011. That's why we haven't had any more QE, because they're scared that they're going to not do anything for the economy, but they're going to boost inflation. To get back to your point, the stock market is a separate game from the economy now. It's trader-driven. It's computer trading, high frequency. It's proprietary trading desk, on and on. Because by and large, over this whole post-crisis recovery, the average investor has been taking money out. They keep taking money out, and there might be some judgment there on the economic prospects and, you know, what's going to happen next. But more bigger issue is people are liquidating to keep solvent or to maintain living standards or just to prevent living standards from falling further. And this is what happens in a very difficult economic environment is people use up their resources. And that is the major issue that we're facing right now, is that this recovery has been so bad that the people that were savers or were able to hang on here are exhausting their resources. And it's one thing to use resources to build for future growth. It's another thing to use resources to survive. And this isn't a supposition as a guess. If anybody goes to talk to accountants, especially accountants that do a lot of business, a lot of small business people, this is what we've heard. We've heard for over a year that people that were smart enough or lucky enough to survive the crisis have just been holding on. And they're exhausting their resources in both maintaining their businesses and in maintaining their household standard of living. And if you don't start getting this economy cooking really good, you're going to have really big trouble in 2013.
Well, David, what Bill's talking about is quantitative easing, which, of course, is a action of the Federal Reserve. It's something that creates money in the system. But it's not just the Federal Reserve, which we have pointed out in the past isn't government. They try to act like government, but they're not government. But our own government's doing the same thing. Let's face it. They're manipulating the markets. They're coming in and creating an artificial environment for the economy.
And for an investor or a business manager, it is a challenge. How do you play when you don't understand the rules as they're being changed, even in the midst of play? And that's to Bill's next point on central planning.
And that is another reason why people aren't playing here. You have unprecedented central planning and government intervention in the economy and the marketplace. Whether it's GM stuffing cars into dealers and government. You know, GM car sales were up 76% in June to government, and they didn't lay off. And one of the reasons you're getting some better economic data in industrial production and jobless claims in July is normally every year in July, automotive workers get laid off because you do your retooling for the new models. They did not do this year. It's strictly political to make the unemployment, make the industrial production look better for the election, because we know car sales stunk. Inventories are building up everywhere globally, so it's largely a political move. And again, once the election passes, this will all disappear, and you're going to have to pay a price. You see this today with the Treasury telling Fannie and Freddie they're going to have to liquidate their portfolios 50% more next year. Right now, they're told that they could have to liquidate 10% a year. Next year, it's going to 15. Why is this important? Because Fannie and Freddie own repossessed properties. They kept them off the market to make the housing look better, to not suppress prices, to not create a problem. There's a lot of things that have gone on to make the economy look for election. It's not just this president. It goes on every election year. That's why you tend to get these kind of plays in election years. But then after the election, the ensuing year, everything falls off. This year, everybody understands this financial cliff thing. It's going to hit in 2013, the tax hikes and the budget cuts, unless something has changed. People see that, but a lot of people aren't paying attention to all the gimmicks that are done to dress up economic data, to make things look better. All these little games are being played because it is an election year. Now, also, you have a lot of spending that is done in an election year, state, local, and government, hiring people for campaigns, hiring people wherever you can, for the same reasons, for political reasons, for there's a lot of workers, a lot of campaign expenses going on that will boost employment, will boost spending. You know, all this money that's raised in the campaigns all this campaigning will all disappear shortly. You know, you see how bad the economy is, and this should be a great year because it's an election year. When it's not, you know, you have to worry about what's going to happen the next year. The stock market, again, is divorced. It's a trader's game. The same thing happened in the summer of 2008. We had the Dow Jones Transportation Average, which is supposed to be the most sensitive economic barometer, made an all-time high in July. The U.S. was at least two quarters in the recession, if not more. How could that happen? It's not supposed to happen. How, the stock market's supposed to lead. Well, it was a trader's game then, and it's even more of a trader's game now.
Now, Bill's next comment takes the 2008 crisis and puts it in a different perspective, basically saying it was a foreshock. The real event is still in front of us, and it's related to our debt markets.
But now it's become apparent to anybody thinking we have debt is not the crisis. The crisis is still in front of us. Because in 2008, it was the financial systems in the world were collapsing from years of abuse, over leverage, lax regulation, fraud, you name it. And that's going on for decades because that was the new economy. That was producing money, whether it was producing tax revenue or was producing graft and donations to Congress. They allowed this to go on. So when it blew up, they could not allow this to blow up and take everything down because the culpability you can put directly at Washington, D.C. and in New York, you know, the financial area. So they had it. They were working together. Now, what we know has happened here, Europe and elsewhere is that sovereign governments bailed out their financial systems to prevent political revolution, if not some harder revolution. In so doing, they've bankrupted themselves. That's the moral of the story in Europe. To protect the big banks, they've bankrupted themselves. Now, because of that, everybody's going all in. They can't stop this game because you will get political revolution. The whole system's coming apart. So, for most people that are alive today, the big hook that Wall Street held over everybody's head was twofold. Yeah, things could get bad, but the Fed is always here to save you. They'll always be able to print money and save you. And the second is, so the government. The government can always save somebody. They may not choose not to. That's the consideration. Do you let Lockheed go under? Do you let certain industries go under? Or do you save them? But now you're at the point where you government can't save. They have to save themselves. So that is what, for everybody alive today, that is the big issue. And that's why you saw this surge in gold over the last 4 years. Actually, three. It's been flat for a year, and there's a good reason why it's flat. But in the aftermath of 2008, every important person, very important person that I talked to, including heads of the big five brokerage firms, CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, these type of people, all were buying gold in 2008 and thereafter. That was their haven because they understood what was going on. Now, why hasn't gold gone anywhere over the last year, even though the banks are pumping? My main thought is two reasons. One is it goes back to this concept of using up your resources to stay alive. A lot of people, especially the wealthy people, have bought what they needed. There was a panic in, and now gold market is kind of digesting all that. The other issue is the Fed, for all the talk about doing QE and POMOs and we're going to pump money and save everybody, their balance sheet is flat on the year. Their asset level is actually down, I think I looked, it's down 17 or 20 billion from a year ago. That's the reason why there's gold blessed its mojo here. And silver's even worse because silver's more of an inflationary play. So for all the talk and all the nonsense going on, the Fed is pretty much unchanged here. So that actually begs a really huge question. Why is Wall Street so excited? Well, you see what the Fed is doing. They sent out the doves to talk about, we're going to give you QE. If things get worse, they've been saying this for over a year. You got the same idiots out there saying, oh, you're going to get QE next week. For a year, major brokerage firms, ex-officials of central banks, and especially this one guy from the Bank of England is running around town, has been saying that they're going to give you QE for over a year. It's not happened. And the one thing they've been able to do is not even do the QE, threaten to do QE. That's what this whole summer rally is. It's the threat of doing QE. Remember how you had to get it because you had to be in here because they were going to give it to you in June. Oh, that didn't happen. They're going to give it to you in August. Oh, that didn't happen. They're going to give it to you September 12th. We'll see. I doubt they're going to do that. So they don't have to do it. And that's, I think, one of the things that is going on here is that because it's only traders, it's a thin market, they can give you the threat of easy money and they're keeping the game going. But they're not giving you the QE here.
Well, and David, it's interesting. That interview was about 4 months ago, and sure enough, Bill was right. You know, by the end of the year, we're coming to the end of the year here, the Fed's balance sheet really was only up about $3.27 billion. So what he was talking about is a phenomenon that's hard to understand.
In Bill's final comment, he's talking about gold not as an inflation hedge, but as a bet against government, and we'll see that this next year.
I think you'll see gold take off. I think you'll see that kind of dynamic in here because they're going to go. They're going to think, well, he's going to try to inflate or do whatever, confiscate, anything. Gold isn't just, people don't quite understand gold. It is partially an inflation hedge, but it doesn't really do a good job as other assets do against inflation.
Not priced in real time. No, it doesn't track on a day-to-day basis by any means.
No. What gold is really a bet against government. I mean, Dan, and that's why the big government people hate gold, because it's always been an encumbrance throughout history, back to the Greeks and Romans. It encumbers big government and wanton spending. And it is a hedge against politics. That's your biggest hedge. So if Romney wins, gold's going to have a tough go for a while. And again, it depends on what policies show up. I don't think we've seen the long-term peak in gold because we have too much in the world that has to be resolved, whether it's the U.S., that debt problem, let's face it. And the thing why the big money is going to, no matter who wins, is going to keep some portion of the gold is because we don't know how the debt problem is going to be ultimately resolved. There's three ways to get out of it. One is totally improbable at this point, and that is to grow the economy. The debt is so large now that studies show it actually has an economic encumbrance now. You just can't get it going. Just like a business. You have a good business, you take on debt to expand, whatever, yeah, you can grow your way out. But if you take on so much debt that there's no way you can pay that payment, and it starts, and then you have to cannibalize your business. That's what is happening now to sovereign governments all over the world. So now you're left with two solutions. And we've talked about this before. You either can inflate or you can default. And every government tries to inflate. We've been doing this for decades. And eventually, you hit the point where you jump to a hyperinflation or you just default, which is what Russia did in 1998, which a lot of state municipalities are going to have to do both because they can't print money. And that is what nobody knows. Nobody has an idea what this endgame is going to look like. So for people, you've got to have a good hedge portfolio right now and flexibility to move once policies start appearing and once things start happening. And that's what's going to make this even more problematic is you don't know from country to country what their policies are going to be or how their legislatures are going to vote and what policies are coming this way. But we do know you've got this major debt problem in Japan, which nobody's talking about, which is even a bigger debt problem than Germany. And there's a lot of things here that have to be resolved. So that being the point, we all know the basis of financial assets are government bonds. And if you start questioning the value of government bonds and ability to pay back, that's where the real crisis will be, as you see in Greece, Italy, on and on. If that starts spreading to France, then to Germany, then to the UK, Japan, US, that's the game changer. Now, the big money over big periods of time, and the big private money plays it masterfully because they don't care about what their performance looks like month to month, quarter to quarter, even year to year. They just want the big trend right. The big money is made moving from real assets to paper assets. In the 80s, that was the game. If you go back in the 70s and you look at the wealthiest people in the world, you had people like Daniel Ludwig, it was oil, gas, shipping, real estate. You know, names like Kluge, whether it was Howard Hughes and his real estate and Hughes Tool and these industries. When you got, as you transit, the hunt brought, you just went through it. That's where your big wealth. Marvin Davis, worldwide. You know, you had the Bellsbergs, the Bronfmans in Canada. It was resources and real estate.
But they had to make the transition.
Well, right. By the 90s, you had the Gates and the Buffetts and those type, and the tech guys and Larry Ellison and on, but it was the paper profit. Now, who played it right? The Bass Brothers did.
Bass Brothers made the transition.
The Bass Brothers were a Texas family of oil, gas, real estate. They had the insight to see something was happening here with Volcker or whatever, and they brought in Richard Rainwater from Goldman, and they brought in a convertible arbitrage team from Kidder, and they played it masterfully. They made so much money in the 80s, they effectively dropped out of sight in the 90s. They did a little of the RTC buying, and they just disappeared. Now, the point here is you've got to move your money from hard assets, whether it's real estate, oil, gas, gold, whatever, to paper, and then you got to make that transition. Now, in the last decade, gold and commodities took off and outperformed stocks by far. But here's your problem if you go to the 80s. You've got to be liquid in transition periods. So in other words, the Basses couldn't just go and buy stocks like crazy at 79, 80. They would have got killed. They transitioned. They got out of their oil and gas, got liquid, did some nibbling around the periphery, and then when the move appeared in earnest, they could go. Where the Hunts went bankrupt and other people similarly went bankrupt, they were ready to go. That's why I can't emphasize enough not to get too doctrinaire here. Don't make too big of a commitment either way right now. Have a nice balanced portfolio so that if something happens very quickly, you are in a position where you're not going to get killed, but also you're in a position to play through this transition. Because, you know, we're not anywhere near the end game yet. You know, we're getting closer, no doubt. And that's going to be very tough to navigate.
Well, David, this is why Bill King is a regular guest of ours. He brings so much insight. You know, one of the things that I think is so important is the timing of exit strategies. That's something that you've brought out. You know, when do you go from commodity to cash, like we talked about with the Bass Brothers? Mark Faber is a person that we also have on a regular basis. And to put those in contrast with the two, that you've got these guys actually continually looking at the market. They're practitioners. They have to make something work because this isn't something that it's just academic exercise or theory. They're actually having to make money.
In that last clip with Bill, there was a dozen things that we could sit and talk about here for the next 5 hours. We're just going to have to let that sit and digest, but there is a tremendous amount of value just in that last 2-3 minutes. The next conversation we have is with Mark Faber. Perhaps you can explore what takes place in a re-evaluation of risk. An asset previously believed to be safe and now scorned, for instance, GSEs, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac paper, which were, you know, truly the gold standard in the fixed income space, you know, giving you the best benefits of high income and the government guarantee. What does it take for perception to switch from something being safe to now being a risk asset?
Yes, this is a very good question, because let's say if we have kind of a gold standard and sound money, in other words, you have an environment where money is not being printed in unlimited quantities, then obviously traditionally the safest asset is to own cash and treasury bills and then government bonds and then municipals and corporate bonds and then equities, and the most risky are basically commodities. But in the current environment, say looking ahead 10 years, we go on a holiday for 10 years and we come back, I think it would be very risky to put all your money into cash and hope that the purchasing power will be maintained over the next 10 years. I think it will go down substantially because we have negative real interest rates, and these negative real interest rates will continue. So under normal conditions, cash and government bonds is safe. But in this environment, in my view, it's no longer safe. Now, what is the safest? Is it gold, or is it real estate at these distressed prices, or is it equities? That we don't know for sure. But I'm quite sure that over the next 10 years, bonds are not a particularly desirable nor a particularly safe place to be positioned in.
Well, David, what Mark Faber is saying is almost exactly what Steve Forbes was saying last week, that bonds are not the place to be, because actually, when you invest in bonds, you're saying yes to the government, you're saying yes to government debt, and that might be the best place to be.
And this final clip deals with the dysfunctional nature of government, not on a partisan basis, but just looking at the growing Leviathan and saying they need more and more. They will be issuing more and more IOUs, they will be printing more and more money, and the whole thing is a bloody mess. You cannot put stock and faith in this very dysfunctional government.
We would have to reduce in the Western world the involvement and the share of government in the economy as a percent of GDP. We would have to reduce that very meaningfully. When with the states, municipalities, and the federal government, the U.S. is about 45% government-related. You know, that is a very large portion, and that stifles economic growth. At the same time, and this is really the work and the merit of Mr. Obama, we have an increasingly cumbersome regulatory environment, which just makes it very unappealing for any business to expand, especially the medium-sized and smaller businesses. They're faced or confronted with a huge increase in regulatory costs. And so they say to themselves, well, why would we hire under these conditions? Why would we expand under these conditions? We better don't do anything. So I think that both under the Republicans and under the Democrats, we have a structural problem that both parties will not solve because of the dysfunctional nature of the U.S. government at the present time.
Well, David, there's, again, so many things that we were not able to listen to that were valuable, but these clips bring out the little gems, and, you know, this is something to do each year. At the end of the year, go back and say, all right, how do we evaluate what we've heard, what we've seen, what we've done, so that we can do more the next year?
As we head into January, we will include some of these kinds of clips from Michael Pettis, John Taylor, the economist from the University of California, Berkeley, Richard Duncan, Russell Napier, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, and a couple of our other guests, because, frankly, there's too many gems, and we have to. We just simply have to. There's too many valuable lessons to learn and points to be made before we transition into thinking about 2013. Now, as we head into 2013, we'll have our anticipations there in a program that is designed to just look ahead and say, what do we expect? That will have in early January. We'll look forward to that.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.